It's been 3 weeks since Hurricane Matthew, and crews along the coasts are still cleaning up. That storm caused more than 1 million gallons of partially treated wastewater to flow into the Savannah River. And that latest spill has gotten a lot of attention. But a recent story in Georgia Health News says many environmental spills and discharges in the state are left outside of the public's eye. The U.S. Coast Guard's National Response Center reports that Georgia saw nearly 560 reported chemical and oil spills last year. How many of those did you hear about? Here to talk about why you may not have heard about them is Georgia Health News editor Andy Miller. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Jason Alseth. He's a Chattahoochee Riverkeeper. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
So let's start first, Andy, by explaining why we don't hear about these spills even when they're in our neighborhood.
That's a very good question. I mean, the most surprising thing of the reporting of that story was the fact that no one really knew about it, whether it was the Flint Riverkeeper, whether water officials, even the airport where the accident occurred. The spokesman wasn't aware of it and didn't really have the right correct information when I asked him about it.
And you are talking about the spill into the Savannah River during the storm.
No, I'm talking about the Flint River situation, which I reported on. But yeah, we don't have a good mechanism for informing the public of spills.
How do you guys find out whether there's been a spill or not? And do you sometimes find out well after it's occurred, Jason?
We find out through a variety of ways, whether it be from a government agency or an industry. And in some cases, we actually find out from the residents downstream that smelled a chemical or saw something in a creek and then had to notify us versus the industry or government agency notifying them.
So, Andy, when people report something, first of all, are they required to report a spill to the Coast Guard or another official agency when a spill occurs?
My understanding is the general rule is anything over 25 gallons of pollution, they have to report to the National Response Center and to EPD. And in many cases, I think that indeed incurs. But where it falls down is who else is informed, whether it's the public or whether it's people, whether it's municipalities that are drawing water off a particular river.
So when it goes to the National Response Center, then where does that information go?
I think it just stays there.
It just goes nowhere.
By and large, yeah. The media often doesn't report these things, and often it becomes something that's apparent by the community. The community notices it, and that way it gets some attention sometimes.
Jason, how serious are some of these spills? Maybe they're not letting the public know about things if they're not a danger to public health.
Yeah, we see a variety of different situations that are created by these spills. One example was in August where we had a chemical spill in Smyrna, and people woke up on a Saturday morning with headaches and running eyes inside their houses because of a spill that happened upstream and went into their neighborhood.
What was the chemical that was spilled?
It was about 2,300 gallons of a carburetor cleaner, which is pretty nasty stuff and stuff you certainly don't want flowing through your neighborhood.
So, okay, Andy, I assume, and maybe I'm being naive, that at some point, if there's any danger at all to my health or my kids' health, that someone's going to notify me. Is there a mechanism in place for that to happen efficiently?
I don't see that happening. I mean, public health and EPD really don't talk, or there's no real intersection between the two. And I think a case like that or a case back more than 10 years ago where there was a big de-icer spill at Atlanta Airport, and it was the community that noticed that their drinking water had a stinking smell. And that's how that whole spill came, kind of erupted in the public eye. So it's kind of, I hate to use the word downstream, but that's what happens. A lot of times it's the community people who notice something. And then people get alarmed, and sometimes the media weighs in at that point.
The media being me and you, Andy. We wonder, well, let's throw this out to our listeners, and I wonder if you've ever had to report on something. Are you confident about the purity of your drinking water? You can tweet us at OST Talk and tell us where you get your information on things like this. My guests are Georgia Health News editor Andy Miller and Chattahoochee Riverkeeper Jason Alseth. Jason, what do you make of the state of our waters at this point? Can we be reasonably confident that they're clean and safe?
Yeah, one thing that's important to understand is that our waterways are much cleaner than they used to be. Back in the 60s and 70s, we've made huge amounts of progress in cleaning up our waterways, reducing the number of spills, but we still have problems, and we're still seeing issues that we shouldn't see anymore today.
Give me an example of a problem that you've identified.
So one example would be American Seal Coat Manufacturing, a company that we received a complaint from on a citizen in 2014. And when we went to check out the complaint, we videotaped them blatantly dumping hundreds of gallons of an oily material straight into a creek. And that's something that, you know, I've been told you could see in the 50s and 60s, and that might be something that would be acceptable back then. But today, I mean, people know better. And that was a blatant, willful dumping into a creek.
Andy, who pays? Okay, let's say that at some point, for example, the de-icer at the airport, and people who are there notice that there's something wrong with their water and they call to complain. That has to be cleaned up, right? Who pays for that?
Well, it's usually, well, in the case that I studied, the Flint River situation, what happened was the company that spilled the jet fuel cleaned it up, and the state and the EPA helped supervise that cleanup. But my main point is this is our most precious resource, and I think that in terms of drinking water, and I think that we as a government and also these companies really have to, you know, get after it in terms of cleanup.
But wait, are there no other ramifications? All once a spill is reported, they just pay for the cleanup and there's no penalty for having spilled chemicals?
In the case of the Flint River situation that occurred in April, there was no penalty for the company that was responsible for the tanker spill. I'm assuming that a lot of these spills, even though they're reported, the public generally doesn't find out about them. But secondly, I think that in the case of the Flint River spill, we know that the company did clean it up. But again, there was no penalty for that company to cause that kind of problem. And I wonder how many times that EPD fines companies that pollute our waterways.
Jason, do you know the answer to that?
Well, we see that there is a huge lack of enforcement across the state. For example, that American Seal Coat Manufacturing case. This was a case where they were willfully dumping oily materials into a creek, and the state fined them $2,000. So there's no penalties out there that serve as a deterrent for other, or there's not sufficient penalties out there that would serve as a deterrent for future potential violators.
So then what do you think how can we change that? What has to change in order for that to happen? Does the law have to change or things just have to be enforced?
The laws are on the books. Georgia has pretty strict environmental policies and laws on the books. Most of what we need is the political will at the top to take these matters more seriously.
You have the river keepers have had to go to court sometimes to get those laws enforced. Is that at this point the recourse for Georgians and for your group?
Unfortunately, sometimes that is the recourse that we do take. So again, in that example where the state EPD fined that company $2,000, we saw that as grossly inadequate, and we took the company to federal court ourselves.
Yeah, in 2014.
Correct, and that ran over into last year, where we got a $10 million judgment against that company, because that's how serious these matters can be.
Okay, so Andy, you had other surprises in your reporting. What were they?
Well, the media, a spill like the one I covered, basically went uncovered until we started talking about it. We reported it. The Flint River keeper wasn't aware of it. The airport spokesman wasn't aware of it to the degree that it happened. There were counties that draw drinking water off the upper Flint, and even though they didn't have an intake on the Flint River going at that time, they weren't aware of it, at least one of them, Fayette County. So basically, I was surprised at the lack of public notice of counties, of public health officials, and basically of the media not reporting anything about it.
We've got about a minute left. Andy, do you think that state agencies make the connection, the strong connection between it spills like this and health?
I don't think that that's happening. And I think in the wake of the Flint, Michigan lead problem, I think that the public is much more aware of drinking water quality. And I think that that connection definitely needs to be made.
What do you think, Jason? Do you, in your dealings with the state, do you feel like they've made this connection between people's personal health and the quality of the environment?
In some cases, yes, but in others, no. This recent carburetor cleaner spill, the emergency response initially from the state was very strong, and it was impressive. But they left pretty shortly thereafter, and we're still seeing chemicals in this creek. And we don't have this method or policy
mechanism
to get this fully restored and cleaned up to protect that neighborhood and public health.
That is Georgia Health News editor Andy Miller. You just heard the voice of Chattahoochee Riverkeeper Jason Allseth. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Gambling laws in the Peach State are some of the most restrictive in the country. Georgia is one of only five states that does not allow commercial, tribal, or racetrack betting. But several large casinos want to make Georgia the next big gambling destination. Companies like MGM and Wynn Resorts are pushing for legalized gambling here. MGM has even unveiled plans for a $1.4 billion casino/resort in downtown Atlanta. Scott Truby has followed this story. He's a business reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
And also with us again is Tibor Besedesh. He's an economics professor at Georgia Tech. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Scott, can you tell us about this planned MGM casino/resort? Because it is getting a lot of buzz.
It's definitely getting a lot of buzz. So they presented a plan last year for a billion-dollar-plus casino with a hotel, perhaps a theater, and restaurants, dining, shopping, all of that. They've come back again this year and said, we're going to give Georgia another shot.
Where would they put it?
It would be in the greater Atlanta area. Before, they scouted downtown Atlanta. This time, they're being less clear about where they would want to put it. I think they want to keep their options open. So they're right now just saying in the greater Atlanta area.
Okay. Let me play Les Bernal, who's the national director of the group Stop Predatory Gambling. So we know where his inclinations lie. He's talking about this claim being made by MGM and other companies that casinos will actually bring more jobs to Georgia.
All you have to do is look at the Georgia state lottery. It started out with, small price lottery tickets. And now, they're selling $20, $30 scratch tickets across the state. They got Keno everywhere. So the only way you keep gambling revenue up is you got to add more and more extreme forms of gambling. The whole thing is just like this race to the bottom, and it's the ultimate, policy failure. It's the ultimate budget gimmick.
Let's hear this second clip from Les Bernal talking about the jobs.
A casino job is the equivalent of throwing your money into the street and then going out and paying somebody to pick it up. Okay, that is the so-called economic multiplier impact of a casino business. They don't create anything. They love to focus on hotels and restaurants that come with it. Georgia, last time I looked, has a lot of hotels and they have a lot of restaurants. I don't need a constitutional ballot question to bring in hotels and restaurants into Georgia.
Tibor, how much do we know about the real economic impact of a casino?
Well, it's sort of the separation is whether it's in a rural or an urban area. There's a question of, do they generate new additional revenue, or is it just shift of spending? So in terms of jobs, in a rural area, a casino may not generate a lot of jobs because you don't necessarily have the labor force there. In Atlanta, odds are it might generate more jobs because there is a labor force that can readily be put to work in a casino because it provides more options for existing labor force. You're not necessarily going to have to bring people into the town to actually perform the jobs in a casino, which is what tends to happen in rural areas. And then whether it generates new revenue is sort of a question of the sort of nature of the clientele that goes to a casino. And whether you actually...
What does that mean?
So, you know, think about, you know, so one way you can think about a casino in downtown Atlanta is it provides another entertainment option to a lot of visitors that come to downtown Atlanta. But the question is, are the visitors that come to town on a fixed budget or a sort of an open-ended budget that can tolerate additional spending outlets, right? So if you have a visitor who comes in thinking I'm going to spend $1,000, then if you have a casino, that casino just diverts a chunk of that $1,000 from something else. If you have a big pocket spender who comes in with an unlimited budget, then a casino provides another outlet for that spending, and it can actually generate additional spending that you would not necessarily have. Right, so it's sort of an issue of who is coming in and whether you actually get more spending or just diverts from existing
sources. So this sounds like what we often get from economics professors, which is you ask a question and they say, it depends.
I'm hedging my bets.
Scott, how does this debate going?
Sure.
I mean, who is for this and who's against it?
Well, certainly the casino companies are for it.
Obviously.
Yes. I mean, there are some folks in the legislature who are for it. Last year, Ron Stevens in the state house proposed a bill that would initially have allowed up to 6 casinos. It was tailored down to about 4 casinos, with one being a resort-style casino. We haven't seen a bill yet. Pre-filing of bills will happen in November, but we expect to see a bill or two to come forward at that time.
Is this a partisan argument?
No, not really. I mean, there are conservatives, religious conservatives, who obviously would be opposed to this, seeing it as a societal blight. But there are also liberal groups who would be against it. So it's going to be these interesting coalitions who will once again form on both sides of the issue.
We sent producers out to ask your opinion on legalized gambling, those of you listening, and here are some of the responses we got.
My name is Marik, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. Yes, I think it should, because, you know, you have some people, they're pretty good at cards, you know, numbers, period. So some people, that's how they pay their bills, and I just think it'll be a good business. The marketing will be excellent as far as Georgia.
Hey, my name is Pamela. I'm from Chicago. I think that Georgia should legalize gambling. I think that it would actually expand your economy, and I think it would be an overall great success for everybody. So I think you should be more open about situations like that and let the people gamble.
My name is Nick Aliota, and I'm originally from Buffalo, New York. I think that they should legalize gambling. I come from a state where it's legal, at least in the Indian Territories, and there's really not much wrong that's going on with it. For the most part, it brings a nice revenue in for the county and sometimes the state, and adds some fun to people who are coming into the city and looking for something to do.
And we got this tweet from Metro Cola, who says, should be a 6-year moratorium on Atlanta casinos, first in second-tier cities, to provide jobs in parts of Georgia that need them. And Tibor, let me take that to you. This is somebody saying, don't take them to Atlanta, where, you know, people, the economics are good. Take them to a city where they're really struggling. I mean, what do we know about casinos? You were talking about the difference between a rural and an urban casino. Is a casino not have the same economic impact in, say, a smaller town?
Well, so it depends what kind of economic impact you're looking for. If you're thinking about jobs in a small town, it might not generate jobs for the existing population because they may not necessarily have the labor skills required for a casino job. If you're thinking about generating new spending and new revenue sources in rural areas, they likely will generate new revenues because they're going to pull in people, they're going to bring people to the small area, right? So it's just a question of what you're after. If it's jobs, odds are you can provide sort of, you can reduce the unemployment rate, if you will, in a larger city much more than in a smaller city. If you're thinking about creating new spending, which generates new tax money, then the odds are you can get more out of it in a smaller area, because in a smaller area, it's going to draw people to that smaller area because it will be the only sort of option of that kind in a larger geographic area.
Right, especially if in the entire state we only had the one
right.
In this smaller town.
Right.
We would love to get your opinions on this as well. Do you want to see legalized gambling come to Georgia? Do you think it'd be helpful or harmful? You can tweet us now at OST Talk. Clarkston Mayor Ted Terry tweets this, 10% of lottery revenues are coin-operated amusement machines, excessive debt linked to several suicides of refugees in Clarkston. So my guests right now are AJC reporter Scott Truby and Georgia Tech economics professor Tibor Beshadesh. We're talking about this continued push for legalized gambling in Georgia. And Scott, to Ted Terry's point, there is this argument that in fact when you get a casino, especially in an urban area, it ends up being poor people who don't have disposable incomes that lose money. How is that being discussed?
Well, you know, we haven't heard that much of the argument yet, but it will be coming up.
And you mean when we get a bill?
Yes, when we get a bill, absolutely. But, you know, for one example, in the state of Maryland, when they legalized gambling, they did see the number of people who had a gambling addiction spike. And they did see the number of people who self-banned themselves, so to speak, from casinos spike as well. So that was, you know, that is certainly an issue. And the treatment for those people will have to be considered in whatever bill that comes forward.
Meaning the cost of treatment.
Cost of treatment, but just the method of treatment. How do we, you know, create a scheme, you know, to help people who might have a gambling addiction?
Let's hear from James Murren. He's the CEO of MGM. He visited Atlanta recently to talk about the benefits of casinos. Here's a short clip from that press conference.
We have the track record of bringing convention business. We are the largest convention operator in the United States in Las Vegas. We know how important that is to Atlanta. And we know we have a good track record in promoting and amplifying business.
He was in a large room, obviously echoey a little bit. But Tibor, he's talking here about bringing convention business in. And this kind of goes to your point about whether that money is just shifting from elsewhere. When he talks about bringing in convention business, is this convention business that wouldn't come elsewhere? Or it's they're just convention business that would have booked into the Hilton if the casino wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, Atlanta seems to be pretty booked with conventions all around. So I'm not sure that you sort of bring anything new, unless the point is that you get even more hotel capacity and you can bring even more bigger conventions. But Atlanta is, I think, one of the biggest convention markets in the country to begin with, outside of Las Vegas, in terms of hotel capacity in a very narrow, in a sort of small downtown area. So I'm not sure to what extent you actually generate additional business by having another casino, at least a convention business. Right? You might generate additional spending, but it's not clear to me that you actually get additional conventions coming to town.
So, Scott, let's go back to this proposed $1.4 billion casino/resort coming from MGM. First, is MGM the best bet in town? Is that what people are considering, either MGM or no gambling?
Well, no. I mean, I think they're the most public. They're the ones who are going through the door first and in some ways taking the slings and arrows, bringing a proposal out there. And they're if not the biggest operator, one of the biggest in the world. And so, but you've also seen Steve Wynn's organization. He's a casino magnate in Las Vegas. He's hired lobbyists. In the last legislative session, you had, I think it was Boyd Gaming and Penn National also had lobbyists. And you had Las Vegas Sands, I believe, also had some lobbyists. So, I mean, there will be others. There's no question about
that. But we're only talking at this point about casino gambling. We're not talking about racetrack gambling or...
No. I mean, there definitely is going to be a horse racing bill come forward for the next session as well. I mean, there are interests there that they came forward last year. They will do it again.
Okay, so the one that we've got, the proposal we've gotten from MGM, how much detail do we have? Have they given us, you're shaking your head already.
Not a whole lot of detail. I mean, beyond saying that they would, you know, if a bill was passed, that they would be willing to spend $1 billion, hire 4,000 people, that it would have...
And that it would also be a resort.
Correct.
That's
it. I mean, you know, in terms of what specifically... We'll go to lottery-funded education programs. We don't know that yet because we haven't seen a bill. You know, we don't know what that
And we don't know what their income is would be anyway.
No, not yet.
So there's no way to project how much would go to education. Okay, let's hear one more comment. This is A.J. Robinson. He's with the group Central Atlanta Progress. And his group actually did a study on the impact, the possible impact of casinos in the state of Georgia.
Number one, what are they giving up? Is it additive? Are they just going to be spending extra money on gaming? Or are you cannibalizing something else that they may have been spending their money on?
How do we get the answer to that, Tibor, before a casino comes to Georgia?
Well, you try to get the information on disposable income of residents, or sort of what, you know, try to come up with data that looks at the people who spend money in downtown Atlanta and how much of their disposable income they're dedicated to that spending. And then try to figure out whether you're going to get substitution or additional spending. Right? And you try to figure out whether, you know, one sort of the issue here is, and MGM was talked about, the amount of money Georgia residents spend on casino gambling outside the state. So you can actually attract some of that money to stay locally and gamble within the state rather than go to Vegas or go to Mississippi or wherever you have legalized gambling. So try to sort of get some notions of whether people are willing to sort of shift that spending and keep it in state or go someplace else.
Go ahead, Scott.
And I was just going to say, so last legislative session, I think the argument was that $400 million goes from Georgia to other states to gamble. Jim Murren, in his visit here to Atlanta 2 weeks ago, I think he said that they now think it's more like $600 million, maybe more.
Although we don't know if people will stop going to Vegas because there's a casino in Atlanta.
But I would also point out that beyond Vegas, there's also the casinos in North Carolina, not far from the Georgia border. Alabama has gaming. Mississippi has gaming. So there are other options beyond just Las Vegas.
So there is one way in which Georgia residents support legalized gambling, and that's if it's to prop up the struggling Hope Scholarship, right?
Yes. We had a poll in the AJC back in January, I think it was, that found that 62% of respondents said they would support casino gambling if it went to lottery-funded education programs like the Hope Scholarship. Now, that was... some number of months ago,
yeah.
And we don't know what the next bill might look like and how things might go forward.
Or we don't have no idea even how much they would set aside for Hope
at this point,
and whether it would be enough to prop the scholarship program up.
Right. Now, there was a study done that said that, and it was backed in part by casino interests, that said that perhaps the Hope Scholarship would begin to run out of money from lottery programs. I think it was by 2027 or 2028. Now, that did not take into account potential changes to the awards that might try to intervene that, or potential new revenue streams either. It just sort of looked at what the funding curve looked like. So that will have some heavy play, I'm sure, in whatever debate comes forward in the next session.
If you take Hope out of it, did Georgians support legalized gambling in the state?
I'm not sure if we actually polled on that specific question.
I'm not sure if you did either, which is it's an important question.
It is.
Because we don't know what's going to be in that bill. We have about 1 minute left, Tibor, and I'm interested in knowing, is there a definitive answer on whether casinos are a good economic engine? And I ask that saying, there are other things you could invest in, right? Let's say that your option is either a casino or something else you might invest in for development. Is a casino an effective generator of either jobs or economic activity?
Yeah, there's no definitive answer. And if you actually look at some of studies that economists have done, they usually actually separate them by whether you're talking about Vegas, whether you're talking about Atlantic City, whether you're talking about commercial operations elsewhere, whether you're talking about tribal casinos. I mean, and that the reasons for sort of differences is that they all happen in very different environments, and as a result, they're going to have very different effects. And Atlanta is a large city, and there's relatively few examples of cities of that size that have gotten a casino. And then it'll be a lot easier to figure out what are the effects in smaller areas in Georgia rather than Atlanta.
We got a tweet from Scott's colleague at the AJC, Willoughby Mariano, says, if you're curious about the impact of gambling on Clarkston refugees, read my story. And she has a link to that as well. We've been talking with, you just heard, Tibor Besedes. He's an economics professor at Georgia Tech. And Scott Truby is a business reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tibor and Scott, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
The Center for Civil and Human Rights and ESPN have partnered on an exhibit that debuts in Atlanta this month. It's called Breaking Barriers, Sports for Change. It's about moments when sports led to meaningful social change. Athletes and political leaders like Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, and Nelson Mandela are featured in that display. Political sports writer Dave Zirin covers exactly this topic. He is the sports editor for The Nation. Welcome back, Dave.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Kevin Martinez. He's the Vice President of Corporate Citizenship for ESPN. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
Dave, what is the sort of defining measure when we call an athlete an activist? How do you know when that happens?
Well, I think we know it happens when an athlete, first of all, is reflecting very real social movements that are taking place off the field. Like, it's not enough for an athlete to have a political consciousness and speak out about a particular issue. It has to be something that is in some way, shape, or form organically connected to a real social shift. which I think is why we can't really speak about the early years of the civil rights movement without talking about Jackie Robinson, or the 1960s without speaking about Muhammad Ali, or the women's movement of the early 70s without speaking about Billie Jean King. And in future decades, when we speak about this era of the Black Lives Matter movement, we will speak about Colin Kaepernick and all of the young people who are taking a knee during the anthem. I mean, that organic connection is very important for us to understand, first of all, when the movement is big enough to reflect itself on the athletic field, and then when that sort of visibility on the athletic field ricochets back into the real world.
Okay, so Kevin, Dave just mentioned, among others, Jackie Robinson, Georgia native, first Black player in Major League Baseball. He's featured in the exhibit. Let's hear a little bit of Robinson talking about one particular trip he took to Atlanta.
On the field for the first time in Atlanta, there were Negroes and whites, other Negroes besides me, and I thought that imperfections are human, but that wherever human beings were given room to breathe and time to think, those imperfections would disappear no matter how slowly.
Now, before I get your response, I want to also listen to filmmaker Ken Burns. I spoke with him about the release of his documentary on Jackie Robinson, and here's what he had to say about Robinson's career.
That's where Jackie's heroism is made, is that being the first African-American in the modern age to sort of, break down a barrier. You can't even imagine the full extent of the opprobrium that was heaped on him, of the slights and slurs and abuse that he would face.
So, Kevin, I think Jackie Robinson is an interesting example because he was specifically instructed not to take political positions for at least the first many years of his career. He was an activist but was silent. How do we evaluate Jackie Robinson's activism?
Well, you know, I think it's important to realize that, you know, the exhibit that we've created with the Center for Civil and Human Rights it's got two particular directions. One is to show that civil rights is linked with human rights, and the second is that there is the ability to tell the story so that people will understand what happened from a legacy position to currently. So to your question, you know, Jackie Robinson was at a point in time where he had many barriers to entry, and that there were very few people that actually supported him, except for some of the leadership in his league team, but also there was a turning point that was happening in society at that time. Many would say that discussion was never finished, and you're seeing now a representation of that. But if you do not have a good comparative, let's just say Tommy Smith at the 1968 Olympics raising his hand in a fist, and the exhibit will show you it's not just the fist, it's what he wore. There's other elements of it. There's a deeper, richer story. How is that similar to what Colin Kaepernick is doing? And the idea is to, ESPN's not going to advocate specifically, but it's going to tell you that there's a story here, and the Civil for Human Rights is building that story to show you how they are inalienably linked.
So then, since you mentioned John Carlos and Tommy Smith, I spoke with them both earlier. I asked John Carlos about actually a pretty large group of people who say athletes should stay away from activism and stick with their own sport.
John, that's a stupid statement. That's a stupid statement. It's the same stupid-ass statement that they made 48 years ago. How do you tell an individual that you are suspended from society because you're an athlete, that you shouldn't have any concerns about the well-being of those individuals that you grew up with in your community? That's like telling a minister he's not supposed to go to church on Sunday.
So, Dave, what do you think of this comment that is often heard, especially recently with Colin Kaepernick, that this field is not the right place to make a political statement?
Well, political statements only have an impact when they're done in spaces that are not the right place. And that's part of the point. I mean, do we want people to fight for social change or not? And if we want people to fight for social change, if we think that's a part of citizenship, then we also have to accept that they're often going to happen in uncomfortable spaces. That's part of protest. It's part of the long tradition of protest. And I think any other analysis of it is if not a misread, even as far as a whitewash or a warping of the actual history of where change comes from. I see this often in how civil rights history is taught, as if The demonstrations and actions in the civil rights movement were just about getting the largest possible gathering of people to march to a place and then just stand around, thousands and thousands of people, to bear moral witness as if there weren't, you know, boycotts, occupations, sit-ins, all sorts of things that made things inconvenient for the majority, for the mainstream, and really forcing them to confront issues that they otherwise wouldn't have to confront. I mean, to me, what Colin Kaepernick and other people who are taking a knee during the anthem, to use that example, what they're doing, I mean, is absolutely in that tradition, because it's forcing people who don't have to think about issues like police violence or accountability, it's forcing them to have to confront it. Sometimes they confront it in a way that's very reactionary, saying, you know, get out of here. This is my field. This is my space. But even if it reaches a small percentage of people to have to think and say, well, wait a minute, why is this a wealthy pro athlete who seems to have everything going for him? Why is he taking this risk? Why is he inviting this kind of hatred? Then it's worth it. And that really is where change comes from.
We would love to hear from our listeners. How important is sports when it comes to social change or justice movements? You can tweet us at OSD Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guest is political sports writer Dave Zirin, probably the only person, Dave, in the country with that title, and ESPN's Kevin Martinez. We're talking about a new exhibit that displays the intersection between sports and social change. And where does ESPN fall on this, Kevin? Because it has been controversial in some places. The Minnesota Lynx WNBA team, over the summer, four players stood in front of the press before the game started wearing black shirts that on the front said, "Change starts with us, justice and accountability." On the back were the names of victims of police shootings. Is ESPN necessarily encouraging athletes to take political stands?
No, we're not encouraging anybody to do anything. Our job, much like yours, is to cover the news. It is on the field to play, or you know, in the locker room, or at the press conference. And if that is a dialogue that happens, which it is happening more frequently than ever, then it's our responsibility to cover it, to serve the sports fan. It's also important to say that, you know, we really need to make sure that we are we understand the dialogue, right? So it is important that from a race relations element that we clearly understand the particular issues. 65% to 68% of athletes are minority, African-American, Hispanic. That's a large population of the people that are actually doing the work, going to work every day, and actually playing sports. But the other piece of it is to really demonstrate that there's clarity in the conversation. Our job is not to take a position, but, you know, appropriately so, once we show Colin on his knee, is there a continued conversation? And the fact is right now, probably due to the election and other things, but Black Lives Matter and the certain violence against African Americans, there certainly is a reason to continue that conversation.
Let's hear a comment from South African leader Nelson Mandela. Here he is talking about the power of sports and sports figures.
Sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little us does. It is more powerful than governments in breaking down racial barriers.
So, Dave, how are we to evaluate, say, Colin Kaepernick's stance? He's certainly not the only athlete taking a stance right now. Serena Williams has spoken out, and others as well. But has his protest been effective, to your mind?
Yeah, it's been effective because it's been qualitatively different from what we've seen in the preceding months. I mean, we have seen over the last couple of years a real shift in athletes speaking out on social issues, centrally the issue around Black Lives Matter. I mean, we saw that at the ESPY Awards, most famously with LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Carmelo Anthony, and Chris Paul speaking out on the podium to start the awards. And what that represented really was a shift from athletes not speaking out at all to athletes saying, well, wait a minute, no, we actually have a responsibility to say something about the world. But if you looked at the content of what a lot of these athletes were saying, and once again, all respect to them for saying anything, because even that, as an athlete, holds risk. The content of it was, we have a role to be a bridge. We have a role to bring peace. We have a role to bring community members and police officers to the same table so we can work out our differences. You know, very much this idea of building a bridge, in the words of Doug Baldwin, wide receiver of the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah.
But what Colin Kaepernick has represented is something different. He's represented the idea, much more in the tradition of Muhammad Ali, the idea of taking a side and saying, no, I'm not here to build a bridge. I'm here to say that there is a position that's wrong. And that position is that policing in this country somehow works. And I think this system needs fundamentally to be changed, to be dismantled, to be rebuilt, and to be a more just system. And I think that in and of itself, him speaking to that, and of course him doing it in the space of the anthem, which inherently says there's a gap between what this flag is supposed to represent and what it actually represents to people of color. I mean, that's electrified people. It's made people very angry.
Yeah.
And it's also inspired people to take part in these protests and to do something very similar. And so that's the part of it that I think is different. And honestly, even though it's upset a lot of people and it's polarized the question, it's also made it much more effective than just saying, we're here to build a bridge, we're here to sit down with police officers, we're here to be somehow this force of peace. And Colin Kaepernick is saying, you know, no justice, no peace.
So, Kevin, how did you make choices about which athletes to include? I want to play this comment from tennis star Billie Jean King. She, of course, defeated Bobby Riggs. It was a nationally televised match in 1973 that was called the Battle of the Sexes. So here she is speaking after that match.
Two things came out of that match. For women, self-confidence, empowerment. And for the men, a lot of the men today don't realize it, but if you're in your 50s, 60s, or whatever, late 40s, you're the first generation of men of the women's movement.
So, Kevin, how did you go about choosing which athletes to feature as activists and which not?
Well, first let me just say that the first thing is to find a partner that could help us and to advise and counsel us on the particular issues that existed both in civil and human rights. And the Center for Civil and Human Rights and Derek Kiongo and Doug Shipman at the time were people that I had worked with when I was the president of the Home Depot Foundation. And I have seen this jewel, this amazing facility, come to fruition. It is one of the most amazing storytelling museums that I have ever seen, and to be able to put civil and human rights together. So we asked them specifically, what are the issue constructs that we should be looking at? So you looked at LGBTQ, you looked at women's rights, you looked at race relations, you look at political, social, economic. So we created this matrix that said, here are the issues that exist in societal elements. Here are the things that are happened in sport historically. So let's give context to that. And then also let's look at currently what we believe are pulsing initiatives or pulsing issues. And then we created this matrix, because the other thing too is we didn't want to leave anybody out. We wanted to make sure that people could see themselves in this exhibit, but also that, as Nelson Mandela said, sports has the unique opportunity to bring people together as no other, organization, program does. So what we were able to do was to start with the big issues that existed from a legacy position with Billie Jean King and Equity for Women and LGBTs with Martina Navratilova. But we also look at, keeping the tennis theme, we looked at, equal pay. And Venus Williams actually was the first person to write a letter saying, you guys, we need to be paid what everyone else is paid it. And that's also in the exhibit. But we also have this element like, it is a full real-time, it's an organic exhibit as well, I should say, is that we're actually going to continue to build it out, such as Colin isn't in the story right now. We should probably put him in the story. People that have recently come out, I think there was a recent person who came out from the Atlanta Dream, Angel, who just recently came out. We need to tell that story so that's relative to what is currently happened. The idea, though, too, is that when you come in, you become your full self, you see yourself coming into this exhibit, and then you can kind of locate the things that you know, the things that you don't know, and then at the very end of the exhibit, we show you how those two things kind of cross-functionally work.
Dave, we have about 30 seconds left, and I wonder if you feel like there has been a shift. Are we starting to see more sports figures take stands like this in recent years?
Oh, sure. Now, there's been a profound shift, and Some of that has to do with social media, athletes feeling like they can speak directly to fans and to the public. Some of that has to do with the fact that there's been a very real movement off the field in terms of whether we're talking about Black Lives Matter, whether we're talking about LGBT athletes coming out, and so then athletes get inspired by that. And some of that has to do, I really do think, from my conversations with athletes, of just pressure from their community to say, hey, you have this role, you need to say something.
That is Dave Zirin. He's a political sports writer, sports editor for The Nation, and Kevin Martinez is the vice president of corporate citizenship for ESPN. You can hear more from Dave in his podcast, The Edge of Sports. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.